to our series on the scriptures and how to interpret it, and we've been looking at ways of understanding the scriptures. We've looked at some of the basic principles of hermeneutics. That's that famous German gentleman who told us how we should understand the Bible. No, seriously, hermeneutics is the science of interpretation. And we've seen the importance of a number of things. We've seen how it is very important to consider what the Bible says in its context, and we looked at examples of context. We saw how by looking at the context you can find that a single verse completely changes its meaning. And so when we're going to interpret the scriptures, we have to do it in a sensible way. We don't have to be silly. Now, there are many silly examples of how not to interpret the Bible. Perhaps one of the best is the Watchtower Society, the so-called Jehovah's Witnesses. You may be aware that they teach that the year 1914 is extremely significant. And I could take you through their argument as to why it's extremely significant. They start in Daniel with a reference to 2,460 days, which turns out to be 7 years. And they say, right, well, it talks about Christ's kingdom being established after 7 years. But it can't be 7 years. So the figure 2,460 must have some deeper significance. So it must be a number of years. Surely must it not? Well, let's jump over to Ezekiel, a completely different book, written at a different time, in different circumstances. And let's find a verse which supports this. And lo and behold, there is a verse early on in Ezekiel which says, a year for a day. So there you are, there's your principle. One day is equivalent to a year. So you take this principle from Ezekiel and you transplant it to Daniel. Completely irrelevant, but in the context, Ezekiel is told, you have got to lay on your side for this number of days. On your right side for Israel and on your left side for Judah, or it might be the other way around. And this number of days you are to lay on that side for the number of years that this people have rebelled. And so each day that you lie on your side represents 1 year. A year for a day. What it's got to do with Daniel, well, that's beside the point. But that's the principle that they wrench out of its context and transplant it into Daniel. And I won't go through all the other arguments, which are all equally fallacious and silly. And to read it out, you would probably be rolling on the ground, holding your sides, laughing. It is so silly. But when I've read this to them, from the book I got upstairs, they've been very serious and said, yes, that's right. What's wrong with that? So it tells you a lot about the mindlessness of those who subscribe to Watchtower Society theology. We're not to take that sort of approach to the scriptures. We're not to dip in here and dip in there and do what some people effectively do, which is to snip out verses here and there and then you paste them together in a scrapbook. And that ties everything together and there's the answer to this particular point. Let's completely ignore the context. Snipping it out is a very good illustration of what they do because it ignores the context and the flow of the argument of the author as it was originally intended. And what we're seeking to do is to find out what the writer meant by what he said when he wrote it at the time. Having discovered that, then we can say, okay, that's what it means, what's its relevance for us, and how should we live in the light of it? What principles do we learn? Because you find in so many areas of life, the Bible doesn't speak directly. It doesn't say, for example, that my wife and I should move to Western Rin. But it gives us principles that we can follow, that we can apply, and on the basis of those principles, we made that decision. So we mustn't be silly. But I want now to give a specific example of a difficult passage to understand. A passage that is very popular in terms of the number of books that have been written around it, the number of books that refer to it. And that passage is, of course, the one we read, Matthew chapter 24. And most particularly, we're going to consider the first 35 verses. What is this passage about? And you go into most Christian bookshops and you will find a whole shelf full, at least, of books all about the second coming, which say that this is all about Christ's second coming, which say that since it speaks here in verse 15 of the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, well, that's obviously a reference to the temple, therefore the temple has to be rebuilt in order for there to be an abominable desolation in the temple, and so on. All these books will say these things quite confidently based on this passage. They will say that there is a great tribulation coming, which is going to be the worst the world has ever seen. It's my comics in which the authors imagine what it's going to be like. The question is this what this passage is about? Is what these people are saying partially right, completely right, or completely wrong? Now I want to come to this passage and apply some principles of interpretation, principles of biblical interpretation, and seek to understand what this passage means. Now what I'm going to say tonight, in fact, does go completely against what most of these books say. But if you look into it in more detail, you will find that what I'm saying fits in very much with what people have said in the past. And there are many people that have written on this chapter who say just what I'm going to say tonight. So this is not some cranky view that I'm propounding. It was a very common view prior to 150 years ago. 150 years ago, or thereabouts, there was a man called John Delton Darby who said that everybody before him had got it completely wrong with regard to understanding the Bible, particularly with respect to prophecy, and that he had now rediscovered, after almost 1800 years, the way in which the Bible should be understood, and that his views have been popularized through the Scofield Reference Bible and through all these other books that I've mentioned. Now, his approach basically was to take a literalistic approach to Scripture. And so he would say that since it speaks here of certain things, these things will literally happen. So to give you but one example, when it speaks here in verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. This must literally happen for this to be fulfilled, he would say. But I would say, is that correct? Does the Bible give us grounds for taking it spiritually, for understanding it in a non-literal way? And I think that to insist we misinterpret the Bible literally is a mistake, because we're not then interpreting the Bible biblically. We must look in the Scriptures and find the biblical methods of interpretation and follow those. And we will find tonight that sometimes that means we don't take things literally. We have to take them biblically. We need to remember, as we come to this, to remember that Jesus was speaking this as a Jew to Jews, and so he had as a background the whole of the Old Testament. And so therefore he uses phrases and concepts in this passage which are found in the Old Testament. And so if we come to this passage without understanding those concepts, without understanding those ideas, we'll completely misunderstand what he says. We'll also completely misunderstand what he says if we come to this passage and immediately think, oh yes, I know what that word means, I know what that phrase says, without understanding the whole context, in the context of this passage in the whole Scripture. Now first of all, as we come to this, we need to look and see where it begins. And it begins as a result of Jesus leaving Jerusalem. He just wept over Jerusalem because of the rejection of the Jews of himself. He's denounced the Pharisees and he says, you're not going to see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. Jesus said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that will not be thrown down. But he is prophesying the destruction of the temple. So they left Jerusalem, they go out to the Mount of Olives. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? When's the temple going to be destroyed? What will be the sign of your coming?" Because he said, they heard him say, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." "And what will be the sign of the end of the age?" Now, there is legitimate dispute as to what Jesus means, or what they meant, and what Jesus understood them to mean by the sign of his coming and the end of the age. There are basically two ways in which we can take this. One is, the sign of his coming and the end of the age refer to the second coming. But the other one is, that the end of the age is the end of the Jewish age. And we have here the beginning of an overlap between the Jewish age and the Gospel age. The overlap between the time Christ was on earth, which was the beginning, that's when the Gospel age began, but he was still living in the Jewish age. And that age came to an end in AD 70 with the destruction of the temple. So you've got this overlap of about 40 years. Is that what Jesus is answering when he says this is the sign of the end of the age? Or is he giving comment about the end of the age, meaning the last judgment? Now that's an important question, because how you answer that question then determines how you understand much of the rest of prophecy with regard to his second coming. Now I don't begin to profess to be the world leading authority on this subject, and many of the things I say tonight are still tentative, and I haven't still finally decided on what my understanding of these things is, but I give them to you as my understanding is now, not because I'm wanting to tell you what I understand about this passage, but to show you how to apply biblical principles to understanding the passage. That's the more important thing to know. We can debate afterwards what our views are on what it means and what it says. But I want to show the application of biblical principles. Now, first of all, there is a key to the understanding of this whole chapter. There is one that is very often overlooked, and that is found in verse 34, where Jesus says, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things are fulfilled." What did Jesus mean when he said, "this generation"? Well, I think we can only answer that in the light of verse 36 of the previous chapter, where Jesus talks about the judgments that were going to come upon the Pharisees, and he speaks about all the wickedness that had been done. Verse 34, "Therefore indeed I sent you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them you will kill and crucify, and some of them you will scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." Right, he's speaking to the Pharisees, those who can hear him. "Assuredly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." He's quite clearly here speaking about the people who can hear him. And I would say, and I can find no reason for believing otherwise, when Jesus says this generation in chapter 24 and verse 34, he must mean the same thing. Now you can read books in which they will insist that what Jesus means by this generation is the generation that sees all these things. But I think that's really twisting things. It seems the only way that can be understood is the generation to which he's speaking. Now, we can see in the previous chapter, verse 36, that's the way he uses it. And you can go through many other scriptures in other parts of the Gospels where Jesus speaks about this generation. This is an evil and adulterous generation, not the generation to come, the generation to which he's speaking, and so on. And I see the only way that this can be taken is he's talking about the people who could hear that generation. If that is the case, we then have to say that all the preceding verses in the chapter were fulfilled within a generation of Jesus speaking those words. A generation in the scriptures is approximately 40 years. And so therefore, what Jesus speaks about here would have happened, if my understanding of that verse is right, would have happened within the 40 years after he spoke those words. And we must then come and look at this chapter and begin to find out whether or not these things did happen within a generation. And immediately people would say, oh, but that didn't happen. What about the sun being dark and the moon not giving its light, the stars falling from heaven, the powers of the heavens being shaken? That didn't happen, so therefore your contention must be wrong. No, not wrong, because people that say that have come to the scriptures with a literalistic approach to the scriptures instead of a biblical approach to the scriptures. What does it say? Let's look at these difficulties, because there are a number. People come to them and say, oh, but this must refer to the second coming. There's no other way in which this can be the case. It must be still at some point in the future. Well, let's go through and let's look at some of these things. Verse 14 we'll take first of all. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Oh. There are still hundreds, thousands of different people groups, as the technical term goes, throughout the world who still have not heard the gospel. They've never seen a missionary, they've got no literature in their own language, they have not heard the gospel at all. And this verse says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world. Well, that's what it says, that's what I believe, so therefore the end can't come until that's happened. This still must be in the future. But that isn't, in fact, what the Bible tells us. That's what you would get just reading that verse. But let's look at a wider context, and let's turn now to Acts chapter 2. Verse 5, the day of Pentecost. And we read this. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. Now, to take the same approach to this verse that people take to the verse in Matthew 24, we would have to say that there were Aztecs present, that there were Incas present, that there were Australian Aborigines present, there were New Zealand Maoris present, that there were Polynesians present, that there were Melanesians present, that there were North American Indians present, that every single nation in the whole world was present on the day of Pentecost. Is that what Luke means? And I would say, not at all. He's talking about the known world, effectively the Roman Empire. That's what you'd expect. Wherever Jews had been scattered to, during their dispersions in the past, they've been scattered to many nations around the Middle East. That is what is being referred to as every nation under heaven. Otherwise, you have to say that Columbus was an insignificant person. He didn't really discover the New World. It was discovered hundreds of years before by the Jews. And they commuted from these other parts of the world to Israel once a year for the day of Pentecost, another great festival. That, of course, is nonsense. But that's perhaps, you might argue, not that clear. What about then Romans chapter 1, verse 8? Where Paul says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. And we can turn over also to Colossians. See again that the term whole world is being used in a sense that is clearly not meaning a literal understanding of that. We need to remember that the scriptures use hyperbolic language. Hyperbolic language being where you speak in a very extreme way to emphasize what you're saying. So, in modern terms, to speak hyperbolically like that, we would say, the whole universe knows about your faith. We don't mean that literally there are people living on Saturn and Mars that know about this. We're saying that everybody that could know, knows. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 6. Speaking about the gospel which has come to you, as it has also in all the world, and is bringing forth fruit, as it is also among you since the day you heard and knew the grace of God in truth. Verse 23. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. We're back in Matthew 24, verse 14. There's no problem here at all. What Jesus is saying, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to the nations. As a witness to them that the Jews heard the gospel. Because the context, the whole context, follows on from chapter 23. We have these denunciations upon the Jews, the denunciations upon the Pharisees. All these judgments will come upon you. And when they come upon you, will men say, goodness me, isn't God being harsh? No, no. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. So when it happens, the nations will say, they've rejected the gospel. That's why this has happened to them. So Jesus is not speaking about global evangelization, to use a modern term. He is talking about the gospel spreading to the then known world so that the Jews will hear the gospel and therefore be guilty. And God will then be clearly seen to be justified in the judgments he will pour out upon the Jews. Verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place. What about this? Well, clearly, if this is speaking about the generation to which Jesus spoke, the temple was still standing. And there was indeed an abomination. And the abomination was the Roman standard. Before Jesus spoke these words, Pilate had forced his way, not he himself, but his soldiers, had forced their way into the temple with the Roman standard. And this was an abomination to the Jews. It was an image, it was an idol. It was hated, and the Jews were going to commit mass suicide to prevent this happening. And it was only because of that that Pilate relented. And so the people that read this would have understood exactly what Jesus meant, the abomination of desolation. We know what that sort of thing is. The Roman standard we see is that sort of thing. Perhaps it's going to be the same. As in fact it was, because in AD 70, the Emperor Titus, he wasn't the Emperor then, finally got into the temple in Jerusalem and took with him the Roman standard. And there you have the abomination of desolation. Verse 27. As the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Well, this can be taken in a number of ways, but I would suggest that all that Jesus is saying, he's saying, look, there are all these people claiming to be the Christ, claiming to be prophets, and they're not. Ignore them, because when the Son of Man comes, there'll be no doubt about it. You won't say he's over here, he's over there. When he comes, you'll know. It will be unmistakable. Now, whether this is a reference to Jesus coming in judgment on the Jews, or the second coming at the end of time, well, that's another question. What Jesus is saying here is, it is clear. When he comes, people will know. There'll be no doubt about it. Whereas all the examples we've given before, there are doubts. Verse 29 to 31. Oh, this is difficult. I mean, these things haven't happened yet. But I would suggest they have, or they happened in AD 70. They happened with the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem. And you would respond and say, but these things didn't happen. There's no account in history of the sun being dark and the moon not giving its light. And I would answer, you're not thinking biblically. Let us see how the Bible uses these phrases. Isaiah chapter 13. We find this phrase. Isaiah chapter 13 and verse 10. This is about Babylon. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, both with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. What account do we have in history of that happening when Babylon was judged by God? It didn't literally happen. It was a cataclysmic event. And to emphasize the cataclysmic nature of the judgment of God upon Babylon, these words are used. Chapter 34 of Isaiah, and verses 4 and 5. This is judgment upon Idumea, or Edom. All the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled up like a scroll. All the hosts shall fall down, as a leaf falls from the vine, and as fruit falls from a fig tree. Then you turn over to Ezekiel, and you find the same again. Ezekiel chapter 32. Verses 7 and 8. This is judgment upon Egypt. Reading from verse 6, I will also water the land with the flow of your blood, even to the mountains, and the riverbeds will be full of you when I put out your light. I will cover the heavens and make the stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give her light. All the bright lights in the heavens I will make dark over you and bring darkness upon your land, says the Lord God. These things did not literally happen, but they were used again to emphasize the cataclysmic nature of the judgment that fell upon these nations. Now Jesus, when he spoke these words in Matthew 24, didn't speak them in isolation. He spoke them against the background of the Old Testament where these words are used in that way. Why should we expect Jesus to use these very words and phrases differently from their Old Testament context? I think it is silly to think that he's speaking differently here than the way that the prophets spoke in the Old Testament. So therefore, what Jesus is saying is, here is a catastrophe that is coming, the destruction of Jerusalem. It is an awful thing. And it's so catastrophic, so cataclysmic, that it's as if the sun was dark, and it's as if the moon did not give its light, etc. Verse 30. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, with power and great glory. Well, this has quite clearly not happened yet, because we haven't seen Christ coming on the clouds of heaven. But is that in fact what Jesus is talking about? If we turn over to Luke 23, we'll find that very similar words are used, and it's quite clear that this does not refer to the second coming. Luke 23 and verse 48. Jesus is being tried, if you can call it that. Sorry, I've got the wrong verse. Matthew 26, not Luke 23. Matthew 26, I'm jumping ahead of myself. Matthew 26 and verse 64. Jesus is being tried before the high priest. Jesus kept silent, verse 63. And the high priest answered and said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, it is as you said. You're right. True. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? Look, you have heard his blasphemy. What was blasphemous about saying that he was going to be seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven? Well, the significance is, these are references to passages in the Old Testament, such as Isaiah, again, chapter 19. The burden against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. The idols of Egypt will totter at his presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst. What Jesus is claiming is to be God, because it's God who comes on a cloud. Daniel chapter 7, and it's probably specifically to this chapter that Jesus is referring when he spoke to the high priest. Daniel 7 and verse 13. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. So Jesus was making a very clear claim to be God, and that's why he was accused of blasphemy. But it shows us that when Jesus spoke these words about coming on the clouds of heaven, he was making reference to the Old Testament. And it doesn't mean that literally he had to come on the clouds. He was claiming that they would see in the events that they saw the evidence that Jesus was exalted on high, that he was seated on the right hand of God's majesty, and therefore coming on the clouds of heaven. It doesn't mean that it has to be taken literally. We can understand it in the same way that it was understood in the Old Testament. Well, what about verse 31? And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. Well, the term angels can also be translated as messengers. And so this, I would suggest, does not mean supernatural heavenly beings flying through the sky and proclaiming a message and collecting people, going around with perhaps a bag or a net and gathering them up. Rather, I would suggest that this is referring to preachers of the gospel going around proclaiming the gospel, and as people hear and believe, that is the gathering in that takes place. Now, what I've said is it doesn't deal totally with everything that is here. Perhaps you might still have questions on what's been said. There are many books that have been written on this subject that make it much clearer than I have. The one that I have found the most helpful is a book called An Eschatology of Victory by an American called Marcellus Kick, in which on Matthew 24 he goes into very great detail, and he gives you a lot of details about what actually happened during the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. And it makes quite horrific reading. He quotes a lot from Josephus, the Jewish historian at the time. And you learn there about all the things that happened. And it was horrendous. That there were false prophets. That there were people claiming to be the Christ. There was the abomination of desolation. All these things happened. But it's interesting that the Christians, as soon as they saw these things begin to happen, they heard Jesus' words. When you see the abomination of desolation, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. That's what the Christians did. None of the Christians in Jerusalem suffered under the tribulation at that time, because they paid attention to this chapter and they got out. They didn't succumb to the temptations of those around them, those that claimed to be prophets or the Christ. They listened to Jesus' words and they escaped. Now when Jerusalem fell, it came as a result of the Jewish war. The Jews rebelled against the Romans in AD 66. And the war lasted 4 or 5 years. And it was a very bloody war. It was awful. It was dreadful. The Romans besieged Jerusalem. And food was so short within the city that mothers ate their own children. To read some of the accounts, it would break your heart as you read them. And they used to have arguments amongst themselves. The mothers would argue amongst themselves about who was going to eat their child next. It was dreadful. Some people escaped. They escaped only to be slaughtered. A story went throughout the Roman army. All these Jews were very rich, and before they escaped, they were swallowing all their gold coins. So as soon as someone came out of Jerusalem, even if it was to surrender, and guess what was in mind for the Roman soldiers? Here comes money. As soon as the Jew reached the Roman soldier, his belly would be split open. The soldier would then look for money and usually be disappointed. It was awful. The atrocities were unspeakable. The Romans ran out of wood to make crosses with because they crucified so many people. If you read about it, it would turn your stomach, and so you can understand Jesus' words when he said, verse 21, "Then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, not nor ever shall be. There's never been anything worse than what happened during that war. Never." And we might think there are many atrocities today, but according to the words of Jesus, nothing will compare to that. It's not surprising, he says, "And if those days have not been shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be short." It was a dreadful state of affairs. But it shows us much better and more clearly the reason why Jesus wept at the end of the previous chapter. "Oh Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall not see me. You shall see me no more until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" So we can see, albeit very scantily this evening, that this whole passage has already been fulfilled in the past, in AD 70. What comes after that, that is another matter. But I believe that the rest of the chapter and the next chapter relate to the second coming of Christ in judgment. And that is why we find no signs given. In chapter 24, verses 1 to 35, Jesus warns people, "Look out for these things happening. When they happen, beware, take note, flee." From verse 36 onwards, there are no signs. All Jesus says is, "You must be ready. You must be ready for the judgment. No one knows when that's going to come. Be prepared. He's going to come back like a thief in the night. He's going to come back on a day that you don't expect. There'll be no signs. Everything will be going on as normal. People will be getting married. People will be eating and drinking." Now that, by the way, is all that Jesus says when he says, "It will be as the days of Noah were." He doesn't mean it's going to be as wicked as it was when Noah was around. It might be, it might not be. All he's saying there is, as the days of Noah were, so will the coming of the Son of Man be before. And here is the parallel he's drawing. "As in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man." That's the parallel. Not that it's going to be as wicked, although it might be, but it's going to be sudden. It's going to be unexpected. No signs will precede it. So there's no way that we can prepare for it at the last minute. Get people who say, oh, but there are these signs to be fulfilled, they haven't been fulfilled yet, don't need to worry yet, I'll leave it a few more years before I repent. That's very inefficient. And that's what is put into the minds of some people. What this teaches us is that God keeps his word. God will judge the unrepentant. So if we believe it, God gives us a greater cause for joy that God's delivered us from such awful judgments. Of course, it should affect the way in which we live. But it should show us, and that's the point of this evening, that when we come to understand the Bible, we shouldn't always just look at what appears to be on the surface. We need to scratch and find what's under the surface. And the thing we need to scratch it with is the rest of the Scripture. We're going to come to a biblical understanding of the Bible. We need to immerse ourselves in the Bible. That means we've got to read it from cover to cover. We've got to start learning what different passages mean. And we'll find that a lot of the things that are referred to in the New Testament, a lot of the phraseology that's used, comes from the Old. And if we know the Old and know where those things come from, we will have a better understanding of the passages in the New. One of the problems is that people have such a poor understanding of the Old Testament that when they come to the New, which they find it easier to read, they don't understand what's being said. Well, let's hope and pray that that won't be true of us. Let's immerse ourselves in the Scriptures, that we know it, that we can understand it, and that we can live by it. But in so doing, we can please God and bring glory and honor to his name.